You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Seattleites working for big retail and food service companies are about to get more predictable schedules as the Seattle City Council, which yesterday passed a law that requires employers to post schedules 2 weeks in advance, pay penalties for any last-minute changes, and offer hours to current employees before hiring new staff. Well, what do employers think about these new rules? David Jones is a Subway franchisee owner in Seattle. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
You and others spoke against this, but Seattle passed it unanimously, 9 council members to 0. How does that make you feel?
Makes me feel betrayed by Seattle. It didn't feel like they were listening to the people that were going to be affected by it, and they didn't surround themselves with those people, and then they went on an agenda that they had and without any council, it felt like.
So what's your take on how these new rules will affect you? What happens next in your business?
Well, there's a couple things that happen. They're real quick and easy is that we have penalty hours for a bunch of different things that are part of our normal routine life, covering sick calls, covering people that quit without giving us a notice.
Penalty hours meaning you're going to pay a penalty for covering that?
For anything covering. If someone goes home early, there's all kinds of red tape to go through without paying a penalty for that. So the one is a cost factor. It's about $1,500 to $2,000 for me for the year, for my projections. Doesn't seem like a whole lot, but it adds up and makes you make decisions, you know, because of that. And the second issue is the posting of a job that comes open. So the restaurant industry is a part-time industry. We have a lunch rush and a dinner rush and a breakfast rush. So we need part-time people to help fill that. And this is a kind of a fight to get rid of those part-time employees. Well, if you have 3 full-time employees when you need 5 staff, 2 part-time and or 3 part-time and 2 full-time, it affects how you can staff and how many people you can have on shift to cover the rushes.
So what is all that going to mean for workers? What's going to happen to your employees? How's their life going to change?
Well, I'm going to try to make it as minimal as possible with how we approach it. But I do know that with minimum wage, I had cut 5,000 hours, not meaning to, but we just do off traffic. That's how we schedule. And I had cut 5,000. So I put some of those back in 2016. I changed my budget for labor. I will have to change my budget back because of this.
You're going to have to reduce hours?
I'm going to have to go back to what I was doing before. So how you would, you know, reduction or not is how you'd interpret it.
Well, David, as you know, this is an attempt by the city to address, as the mayor said, income inequality. Councilmember Gonzalez says we're shifting the power to workers. In other words, workers have had a tough time the last several years in this economy. What's wrong with giving a boost to workers?
There's nothing wrong with giving a boost to workers, but what's wrong with helping small businesses stay alive? You're trying to survive everything just like the employees are trying to survive. If you give all the power to the employees and you take all the power away from the small business, where are they able to make decisions that help them stay in business? Some of these things that they're taking away from us are going to affect people staying in business, and they don't seem to care about that, and that affects employees.
A lot of workers will tell you we are a long way from all the power being in the hands of workers, that they've got a lack of predictability, which means they can't plan their lives. They can't get child care. Some people are living, you know, on a razor's edge. That's the argument, right?
That's the argument from labor. And if you went to these meetings, I went to all the meetings. If you went to the meetings, it was labor that showed up to talk. It wasn't employees. If you talk to my employees, they don't agree with this legislation. So the city talked to labor. Labor said, hey, we've got these issues, but it was all labor. It wasn't actual real employees. And the real employees that spoke up were the full service workers in Seattle who spoke out loud enough where they took them off the initiative completely.
David Jones is a Subway franchisee, so people think, Subway, you're a big company, but this applies to you even though you own your small Subway business. I understand. Well, I talked to a Subway franchisee who told me straight out, I'm looking to get out of the city. My business is up for sale, partly because of this, partly because of minimum wage, higher minimum wage. What's going on with your Subway franchise?
Well, I have 2 in Seattle. One is very strong, so I consider myself a leader in Seattle. I want to do what I can to stay there and help other franchisees. But I talk to people all the time, every week, that are planning on moving out of Seattle or planning on selling.
What would help you the most now if it applied, these rules applied to smaller businesses to level that playing field, or if King County adopted it so that you're not competing against your neighbor and over the border?
Well, it's pretty unfair that they pick on the franchisees. They don't want to meet us and get to know that we're actually really small business. They're just listening to the labor's rhetoric about us. But it's pretty sad to me that that's who they pick on, and the law isn't important enough to have it go with everybody, but we're going to pick franchisees to make them be the guinea pigs, and that it's just a sad reality for Seattle.
Subway franchisee owner David Jones in Seattle, one of the businesses that the new secure scheduling laws will apply to. Thanks for coming back and talking with us, David.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. Some people manage to find beauty in the darkest places. As part of her ongoing series, Art of Our City, KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman introduces you to a man who made art in an internment camp.
Shoji Kawabata peers closely at a black and white photograph.
I don't remember doors like this. It was not Minidoka.
Kawabata's memories have faded a bit since this photo was taken 75 years ago, but he's pretty sure it's not a picture of the Minidoka Relocation Center. That's where he and his family spent 4 years during World War II. The Kawabatas were among thousands of Japanese Americans interned after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Kawabata remembers that day very well.
My dad liked fishing, so we were fishing, and we came back to the boathouse, and nobody would talk to us. And when we got home, of course, we learned about Pearl Harbor.
The following spring, the Kawabatas were sent to Minidoka, a bleak camp in the Idaho desert.
There was nothing. Sagebrush, ticks, coyotes, scorpions, black widow spiders.
Harsh conditions didn't stop internees from creative pursuits. They formed musical groups, needlework clubs, even a camp newspaper. 12-year-old Shioji liked to work with his hands.
Well, my father was a carpenter in camp, so he got me the piece of wood.
Kawabata carved a chain of interlocking circles, about 2 feet long, all from that single piece of wood. After the war ended, Kawabata brought his delicate wooden chain back home to Fife, one tangible reminder of his 4 years in Minidoka. He doesn't really talk much about those years. Shikaraganai, he says, it couldn't be helped. Shoji Kawabata never thought of himself as an artist. He worked as an auto mechanic for most of his life, 40 years. He marvels at how much American culture has changed since his time in Idaho.
I was scared to go into Twin Falls, and I had to be careful when I walked around the corner. Somebody's going to beat me up. And now I go to the ball games, and they're all rooting for Ichiro.
From Auburn, that's The Art of Our City. I'm Marcy Silman.
And you'll find photos of Shioji Kawabata's wooden chain at our website, KUOW.org. Do you remember the scene in the movie A Christmas Story when Ralphie's helping his dad change the car tire and then the tray holding all the tire bolts gets knocked over?
There we go.
For one brief moment, I saw all the bolts silhouetted against the lights of the traffic, and then they were gone.
Oh, fudge.
Only I didn't say fudge. I said the word, the big one, the queen mother of dirty words, the F-dash-dash-dash word.
What did you say?
Yeah, he said the F word, the queen mother of all the cuss words. Why is it that saying the F word is so shocking to us, and at the same time we find saying it and other swear words so appealing? Well, Benjamin Bergen tried to answer those questions in his book, What the F? Bergen is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. He told me the F word wasn't always a terrible word.
at the time of Shakespeare, it was kind of like Screw. The competitor at the time that filled the role that the F word now fills was Swive, which has totally fallen.
Get out of here, Benjamin. Get out. How dare you?
I didn't realize that you were 500 years old. I mean, I know that radio is an old art form, but yeah. So the F word has become more profane. It was decided probably by the 18th century that it was really not appropriate for diaries and letters of the upper class and so on. But it does have certain features that lend it some impact as a profane word in English, and it sounds like a lot of other profane words. You know, we talk about English profanity casually as four-letter words, and we do happen, that word, among others, we do happen to have a lot of profane words that are four letters long, but what they really seem to share is that they're one syllable, like the F word is, and they end with consonants, in particular, hard stop consonants, like k and t and so on. And these words that sound this way, that pattern this way for English speakers, sound more profane.
So the F word didn't used to be that bad, considered that bad. Now it is the convenient one-syllable hard-stop word to throw in all of our angst or something about why do we have to have a word that bothers us so much? You're a cognitive scientist. Mm-hmm. But what's going on around that word that we're throwing our discomfort into it?
Well, the first thing to say is that we don't have to have a word like that.
So that's interesting. Yeah. Are there cultures that don't even have a version of that?
Exactly. So if you look across the world, you'll find that not only are there languages and cultures that don't have that word, there are languages and cultures that don't have the concept of profanity, that don't have such a thing as a class of words that need to be bleeped if you're going over the public airwaves, for example. So Japan is such an example. There are lots of ways to insult a person in Japanese, but there aren't any words in that train of insults that you could let loose on someone that themselves are vulgar, that themselves are violations of a social agreement that we won't say these words in public. So there doesn't have to be such a thing as profanity. We just happen to have it and have it in spades.
What is profanity to you? Maybe everybody doesn't agree. What's profanity?
Well, there are words that a culture decides are inappropriate for certain sorts of settings. They're inappropriate for use. It could be around kids, it could be in public, it could be in formal situations. We decide that these are the bad words, not what they mean, but the words themselves. Those sequences of sounds used in that particular way, those violate a social norm.
But they are related to certain topics, right? Obviously, sex and religion figure prominently.
That's two of them. They also are often drawn from body parts and things that come out of them, and then also slurs, so terms of abuse for groups of people. Those are sometimes lumped together with the rest of profanity and sometimes not.
But you make a distinction, an important distinction between profanity and slurs.
That's right. So slurs, they behave somewhat differently. We actually know that slurs can cause harm. We know that they lead people to become more discriminatory in their behavior towards marginalized groups when just overhearing a slur. And we know that, at least from correlational studies, middle school kids who hear a lot of slurs directed at them over the course of their 6th through 8th grade years also report that they don't feel as connected with their school, and they report greater degrees of depression and anxiety.
But the research does not tell us that profanity, that cuss words, harm children, right?
That's right. The words related to sex or body parts or religion, there's no evidence whatsoever that outside of the context of verbal abuse, that these terms by themselves, whether you're stumbling over a piece of Lego or a child gate or something like that, that they will cause harm to children of any type, really.
Do you have kids, Benjamin?
I have a kid, yeah.
How old, if
he's,
I may?
He's 2.5.
2.5.
Yeah.
Do you or will you swear around that child?
I do and I will. I think as our discussion has kind of has illustrated, there are certain words that are known to cause harm, these slurs that denigrate people based on their ethnicity, religion, sex, sexual orientation, and so on. We know there are bad consequences of using those particular words. I don't use them, and I certainly don't use them around my kid. I don't want him to learn that it's normative to use those words. On the other hand, the rest of the stuff, you know, when I'm trying to cook and I spill boiling water on myself or something, I'm not censoring myself. And what my kid is going to learn is that when people are experiencing very strong emotions, there is a thing that they do linguistically. There is a set of words that they use to express those strong emotions. And it's not just bad emotions. It's also when I'm excited because the Chargers scored a touchdown against the Seahawks, for example, if that were to ever happen. you know, the kid is learning that there are words that have power and are used in moments of strong emotion. Now, the thing that he doesn't see and the thing that he has to have explained to him is the social norms. You know, that if he were to use this word at school, his teacher might not like it and there might be consequences. And that type of social learning is something that I feel he is best able to learn if I demonstrate the behavior that I want him to learn, and if I coach him on all the nuances that might be hard because the social world is invisible.
Do you think the world, Benjamin, would be even a little better place if the rest of us swore more than we do?
I don't know. You know, I'm not that kind of... I'm more of a scientist who describes rather
You're
than...
You're also a father who swears.
That's true. I can tell you, it works for me. So in my household, I would feel less comfortable if I weren't myself in all of the ways that I'm myself at home. And, you know, I try not to harm my child, and this is a way that I believe I can be myself and not harm my child. I certainly don't think that there would be enormous harm or any harm at all caused by changes in censorship regulations that the FCC imposes on broadcast radio and television, or that the MPAA imposes on motion pictures. Like, if there were a lot more F words and SH words and so on in movies, I don't think that would make the world a worse place.
It would eliminate something I feel is dishonesty, when everybody knows what you're talking about, but you're pretending they don't. That bugs me.
You're not the only one. So my book is called What the F, and I didn't want that to be the title originally, right? For exactly that reason, because that big red F, it means something, and you're trying to have your cake and eat it too, right? You're trying to evoke this concept that everyone knows exactly what you're saying, and yet you're trying to play it off like, oh yeah, but you know, I'm being genteel about it. It feels a little false. I totally agree. On the other hand, we do live in a world governed by these social norms. In fact, by legal norms. So we can't swear right now into these microphones, have it recorded and broadcast, because your station will be fined. That is a consequence of that. That will happen. And so, and in the same way, advertisers, bookstores, for example, they shy away from the use of these words. And so there's this partial solution of abbreviating, you know, saying things like the F word or effin' this, or even using minced oaths like frickin'. These are...
Fudge, like in Christmas Story.
Right. For example, shut the front door.
Shut the front door. That one was kind of fun. I got it.
It's pretty good, right?
For a short time.
You know, these are solutions to a social problem, and we may not be comfortable with them, but for many purposes, they're really the only way that you can do the work.
But say your child doesn't pick up on all the nuances. Now you've raised a kid who's foul-mouthed, and it's your fault.
That's right. That's one of the big concerns that parents will often raise. If you swear around a kid, he's going to learn to swear, and that's going to reflect poorly on the child. He's going to be punished. That's going to be bad for his ability to succeed in school. It's going to look bad on you as a parent. You're not going to get elected to the school board. But guess what? The kid's going to learn those words anyway. It's not hearing you say it that's going to be the main impetus for him.
But I'm the role model.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And you are a role model who can exactly demonstrate the situations in which it is and the situations in which it is not going to elicit consequences, undesirable consequences, to use those words. Pretending that they don't exist or pretending that you don't know them is, well, it's kind of the same thing as abstinence-only education or other sorts of really unsuccessful ways to try to censor behavior that always end up producing more unbridled excitement for those very same behaviors that you're trying to stop.
You know, my gut is that just us talking about this like it's just a word and not all cultures feel the same and all this, just doesn't it seem to let the air out a little bit? like to make the whole profanity thing seem a little silly for grown-ups?
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, that's what the book is supposed to do, just turned up to 11, right? Once you start to not just treat the word as a word, but to treat it as an object of science that you can ask questions about, that you can study, that you can ask, how does it affect people's bodies? What happens to heart rate when you hear this particular word? You can ask, what part of the brain produces this particular word? Are there things to learn about how humans evolved language and how our brains manage to produce words without making lots and lots of mistakes that we can learn specifically from profanity? Then it becomes not just, well, it becomes not a sort of fetish object like it has been, and not just deflated a little bit, but actually something of value, something that you can use as an instrument.
Benjamin K. Bergen is a cognitive science professor at the University of California, and his new book is called What the F? Well, no F-bombs that we know of today at the U.S. Senate Banking Committee in Washington, D.C., but the CEO of Wells Fargo was there enduring some harsh words about his bank's sales tactics. Bank employees opened as many as 2 million unauthorized accounts in order to meet sales goals and collect bonuses. Wells Fargo agreed to pay a fine, but did not acknowledge any wrongdoing. Well, here's Senator Elizabeth Warren telling Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf that he is gutless for scapegoating his low-level employees.
You should resign. You should give back the money that you took while this scam was going on, and you should be criminally investigated by both the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission.
We'll bring you the entire Wells Fargo story coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW, Seattle, and The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. Workout clothes are not for you. That's the message some women get when they try to buy exercise clothes that fit them. Professor Deborah Crystal at Washington State University conducted a study on women size 16 or bigger who try to buy workout clothing, and she found they often have to cross-dress to find their size.
The main thing that we found was that plus-size women feel it's impossible to be obese and feminine, especially in their exercise clothing, and that the majority of them resorted to wearing men's clothing and simply in order to engage in exercise. And one other thing that we found that was interesting is that they felt the only way they could be feminine is if they lost weight.
Yeah, you found that over 75% of the plus-size women you talked to said they had to shop in the men's section for clothing. How does that happen? Can you tell us one woman's story?
Yeah, one participant, she said that her husband was a little bit larger and so was her son. And she would use them as an excuse to buy clothing for herself. So when she was shopping, she would go into the men's section with this mentality that, oh, I'm just getting workout clothes for my husband or my son. But really she was looking for herself because she'd gone so many times to the women's department to find workout clothing and nothing would be either her size or there wasn't anything that she liked if it did fit her.
How do women react to having to shop in the men's department?
Well, I think the problem is that if a person, regardless of their body shape, size, if they don't want to wear men's clothing, then they shouldn't be forced to. And it's the limited options for this demographic that are really providing them with no other options. And most of the women said, we love to be active. I like working out. It feels good. It's instinctual to want to move your body. But it can be really uncomfortable when you're asked to wear something that you don't feel expresses who you are or that you can identify with, and particularly if it's a different gender, because when you look at someone, the very first thing that the human brain does is says, is that a man or a woman? And when a woman is wearing men's clothing, the default assumption is, oh, you know, they're cross-dressing or they must be gay. And a lot of all of the women in our study identified as heterosexual, and they said, I don't want to be perceived as, you know, gay or LGBTQ because I'm not. And they weren't saying that there was anything wrong with that, but personally, that's not how they wanted to be identified. And compromising your identity is really emotionally draining. The woman we talked to said, I can't be obese and feminine. And the only way to be feminine is to be thin. And I don't think that's right.
So the lack of fashionable and attractive clothes, that can keep somebody from working out.
A lot of women in our study said that there were days when they would get up and look at their workout clothes and just feel totally deflated and lose their motivation and say, ugh, I don't want to do it. But on the other hand, some plus-size women that have been kind of in between, where they're just on the verge and they can fit into the high-profile, you know, fashionable clothing brands, they love it. And they say, I feel so cute when I can put on my cute yoga pants, and it actually motivates me to be more active.
Is there any hope in a trend away from strict gender roles and toward androgyny, or does that not really play out yet in the gym?
No, I think there is some hope for that. And I'm really happy that people are able to express themselves in any way that they want, especially, you know, with the strides that the LGBT community has been making in regards to expressing yourself in any kind of gender that you identify with. And I think the fashion industry is helping to provide options that are less gender specific. But for the majority of fashion brands, they do, you know, either target men's or women's.
And this is not just about workout clothes. Describe how American retail fashion can work against women, especially plus size women.
You know, self-esteem, clothing, and confidence are all tied in together. And I think that if we, not just academia, but the fashion industry, wants to enhance the world and make people feel good, then everyone should be able to feel comfortable and confident in their attire, whether it's working out, going to an interview, going to work. And you're totally right. There's so many different roles that people play, and plus size women are at a disadvantage in being able to pick and choose different roles that they can play because of the limited clothing options. And most people don't think that. The assumption and thought is, well, you know, if you want to wear our clothing or participate in this activity, then you'll just lose weight. But it's not that simple.
Deborah Crystal is a professor in Washington State University's Apparel, Merchandising, Design, and Textiles Department. This summer, she told me she's teaching a fat studies class at WSU, where she will talk with her students about fatness as a social justice issue. Professor Crystal got a shout out from the fashion designer Tim Gunn from the reality show Project Runway. He cited her research in a piece that he wrote about women's fashion in the Washington Post. So we're going to tweet a link to that piece right now on Twitter at KUOW. This is what a high school girl had to say about how she looks. My whole life is an attempt to figure out what I actually like versus what I want to hear from other people or wanting to look a certain way to get attention. And part of me feels cheated out of my own well-being because of that. That high school student was talking to author Peggy Ornstein. Ornstein told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel that struggle girls experience over how they're supposed to look, it starts early on, something Ornstein discovered while writing her first book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter.
You know, so much of how girls are taught to present themselves is about pleasing, is about, you know, defining femininity through being desirable rather than understanding any aspect of your own desire. And a big part of that now is being hot. You know, being hot is more important than anything. You have to be hot first. I mean, you see that everywhere, even in feminism. You know, one girl said to me, could Beyonce say what she's saying if she didn't look the way she looked? You know, do you have to be hot even before you can get a feminist message out? And hot is this just very narrow, superficial, commodified idea about what's attractive that tells girls over and over that how their body looks to somebody else is more important than understanding how that body feels to them. Whereas women of a different generation, baby boom women or Gen X women, may have seen that idea as a kind of push towards self-objectification or self-sexualization. Young women today consider and are sold that idea as confidence and power. And so one of the girls that I talked to, you know, as an example, just showed me a picture of herself in a crop top and a short skirt and high heels going out to a party. And she said, I'm proud of my body, and I never feel more liberated than when I'm wearing skimpy clothing. And a few minutes later, she said she wouldn't have worn that same outfit a year earlier because, as she put it, some jerky boy would have called me the fat girl, and that would have been bad for my mental health. And so then, you know, you have to ask, well, who gets to be proud of which body, under what circumstances, and who decides that? And how liberating can it be if humiliation lurks just around the corner?
How has this affected your own thinking about gender and what it means to be a woman versus what it means to be a man and how that's represented?
Well, I guess it affects me very much as a mother, you know. I think very hard about wanting my daughter. I try to take the long view, you know, with my daughter, particularly obviously she's not sexually active. She's in seventh grade, but I think about what I want for her. And I think about what I want for her in her sexual relationships, whether those are also intimate emotional relationships or not. I think about what I want for her in the workplace. I think about how I want her to present in the world. And so we discuss all of these things. And when we talk about how women's bodies are portrayed in the culture, you know, I want her to notice that difference. And I want her to notice that that doesn't have any connection with how their bodies feel. And I, you know, we talk about the selfie culture. We had a conversation the other day where she had gone on a field trip and out to the beach. And you know, I live in Northern California, so it's cold and nasty at the beach. And the wind was whipping and the sand was stinging. And she said, nonetheless, several of her classmates got into their bikinis, her female classmates, and took Instagram photos that they posted of the fun, frolicking time they were having on the beach. And she said, Mom, you know, that was a lie. That wasn't, why do they want to put up something about their lives that's a complete lie so that other people can think they're having a good time? And I sort of said, honey, if you can hold that thought for the next 7 years or so, I will have done my job.
I was just thinking that how great it is that she's able to recognize that in seventh grade, but it may not necessarily be the same for her when she's in 11th grade.
Exactly. I don't know. Right now, she's not on social media, so she's not being raised by it, and she's not absorbing its rules and roles for women as part of her identity. But I don't know, you know, that will not be forever. And social media is one of the things that has, I don't think it's caused any of this, but it reinforces and amplifies the ways that girls are encouraged to present. I mean, every girl knows that you're going to get more likes if you put up a bikini shot than if you put up a shot of yourself in the parka. And the likes and the comments, which are very, you know, it's a language that we don't really speak, the language of comments, but that girls know exactly what it means. If you say cute versus gorgeous versus, you know, versus, oh, you're so hot, you know, whatever. Those things all have particular shades of meaning, but they're all about how you look. The comments are always, it's always about expressing yourself. Girls talk about expressing yourself, but it's expressing yourself in how you look, not who you are, what you do, what your character is, what you're good at, what you enjoy. It's a very narrow idea of self-expression for the most part.
You've brought up your daughter a couple of times, and you even gave an example of her being able to see other girls that she goes to school with kind of fake something in order to present themselves a certain way, wearing bikinis at a freezing beach. How do you have conversations with her that, I don't know, how do you build a foundation so that these things she's thinking about now stick, that they stay with her when she's 15, when she's 20. And I'll be honest, I'm asking as the mother of a 4-year-old girl. I have no idea how to have these conversations with my daughter and how to protect her from
this.
Why
would you, though? Why would you? You know, because who had them with you? You know, so I mean, honestly, I have been talking to my daughter about these things since she was 4 years old in you know, a little 4-year-old way. Like, why do you, when we watch Despicable Me 2, you know, I don't know if you've seen that, but there's this character, it's just a random thing that I'm picking, but there's a female character who's supposed to be the strong female character in that movie. She's a detective or something. And in the whole movie, she's, first of all, her eyes are bigger than her waist. And secondly, she's wearing high heels. And through the whole movie, and I, at some point I said, hey, I wonder how she runs in those high heels. Doesn't a detective have to run to catch the bad guys? That's kind of weird, huh? I mean, just sort of pointing that stuff out when kids are little, for boys too, you know, I think is important. Now, honestly, that my daughter's more towards a teenager and getting to that age where a lot of kids will plug their ears and hum and run from the room if you bring up sex. What I did, I cheated, and you can cheat the same way by, you know, by listening to interviews like this. I took her to a couple of my events that I was doing for the book. She's come to a couple interviews with me, and those things open up a lot of conversation between us. And I've heard a lot of people, you know, even more than the book itself, the media that I've done around the book, like an interview like this, they listen to it with their teenagers, and it's a way to enter into that conversation. And by the time a child is in ninth grade, I think, or a rising ninth grader, they can read this book. It's accessible to them, and it's a great book to read in tandem with your child in order to discuss these issues. And, you know, you have to have an entry point. And what I found is that girls, if given the entry point, they can see things are unfair, and they are trying to struggle to figure out how to create a context that works for them, too. So we just need to give them the opportunity and kind of get over our own squeamishness about it.
Talking with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel, that's Peggy Ornstein, author of the book Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. You're listening to KUOW Seattle. Some Northwest cities and counties and private developers are going beyond the minimums in the state building codes to reduce the risk of wildfire. They're banning shingle roofs and requiring fire-resistant siding. They're also making homeowners mind their landscaping. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has more from outside of Spokane.
Developer Chris Heftel made an interesting choice when he converted a forested hillside and grazing land into a gated community called River Bluff Ranch. There are websites and brochures full of advice for how to build in wildfire country like this. In this development, though, the tips are not merely advice, they're the rule enforced by covenants on the properties.
If it was voluntary, you'd have some compliant, some non-compliant. The non-compliant homes put everybody else at risk.
Heftel takes me to a lane of custom homes and points out common features, such as the asphalt composition roofs.
Almost impossible to set those on fire from an ember or something coming down and landing on them, as opposed to, say, a shake roof.
Home siding also has to be non-flammable or fire-resistant, typically accomplished with fiber cement board, such as Hardy Plank, accented with stone veneer. Landscaping is the other critical piece.
It's not just the construction materials, but it's also maintaining the defensible space around your home.
Individual homeowners must keep their yards lean and green, as they call it. Many install a rockery ring around their foundations. These measures combined can't guarantee a fireproof neighborhood, but Heftel says they would affect a wildfire's behavior around the homes.
It's going to burn much less hot and probably travel more slowly, easier for fire responders to get it under control.
Two other Northwest developments taking this approach to be safer from the start include the big Suncadia Resort near Roslyn, Washington, and the Tree Farm subdivision outside Bend, Oregon. At River Bluff Ranch, resident Mike Thompson says FireWise features were on his mind when he and his wife were house hunting.
Knowing that the developer, Chris, had gone through and done limbing and cleaned out the underbrush and done some of those things to make it more protected was definitely something I think for us was a good selling point.
Thompson says he doesn't think he paid all that much more for his fire-resistant ridgetop ranch home. The retired fire chief now heads the development's homeowner association, which provides ongoing enforcement of those covenants. So that's a case where a developer and homeowners are imposing rules on themselves. a slowly growing number of Northwest cities and counties are applying similar rules to everyone who builds in wildfire-prone zones.
You know, and I'm an advocate for property rights.
Former Kittitas County Commissioner Alan Krankovich got the ball rolling for his central Washington county to adopt what is known as the Wildland-Urban Interface Code.
You are asking to build a home in an area where there traditionally has not been. So now, to me, to allow you to do that, comes a personal responsibility to provide some protection for yourself as well as the surrounding landowners.
California years ago led the way on this. Yakima and Douglas counties in central Washington and Jackson County in southern Oregon have also added wildfire protection rules to their building codes. The cities of Wenatchee and Boise have too, motivated by experience with destructive fires. Cowlitz County, Washington, looks to be next in line to act. Bend, Oregon, and surrounding Deschutes County are also taking a hard look at this. But that leaves far more Pacific Northwest counties not on board. Earlier this year, a firefighters association asked the Washington legislature to make a model wildfire code apply statewide. But realtors, home builders, and counties snuffed out that proposal with the argument that a one-size-fits-all solution is inappropriate. I'm Tom Bonsi in Spokane.
It's KUOW's The Record.
Feeling is not much to go on.
Sometimes a feeling, Mr. Spock, is all we humans have to go on.
Captain, you almost make me believe in luck.
Why, Mr. Spock? You almost make me believe in miracles.
50 years ago this month, the TV show Star Trek premiered on TV, and here in Seattle, the EMP Museum is looking into some of the show's more timeless themes with an exhibit called Star Trek: Exploring New Worlds. The curator, Brooks Peck, says the exhibit challenges visitors with some of the ethical dilemmas the crew of the Enterprise faced.
We have a number of touchscreen interactives that I call away team encounters, and they pose interesting moral or ethical dilemmas to our visitors, the kinds of dilemmas that you encountered on Star Trek or that the crews encountered on Star Trek. Things about when it's right to interfere with another civilization or not. And so it asks visitors these questions, and they can choose what they think is the right thing to do. And then it shows them a number of examples from Star Trek about the different ways this question has been approached. What I hope happens is that people will then engage a little more in some of those heavier questions that Star Trek was so often grappling with. And certainly, looking back to the original series, it's the episodes we remember the most now are the ones that grappled with interesting issues.
What are you thinking of?
Well, look at Plato's Children. That had one of the first interracial kisses on television, where Shatner and Nichelle Nichols kiss. And at the time, it's hard to realize it now. It's hard to sort of put ourselves in that mindset now, which is a very good thing. But at the time, this was an incredibly big deal. And the networks were nervous and the censors were nervous. And everyone was taking a big step. Or another episode that in the original series that tackles race in a very theatrical way. It was called Let This Be Your Last Battlefield. And there are these aliens, right? And these aliens are either black on one side of their face or white and white on the other side of their face. Or it's reversed. They're black on the other side and white on the first side. And they hate each other because of that difference. It's a way that Gene Roddenberry, the series creator, just was able in a science fiction way to point out how ridiculous this is that we're having all these race issues at the time in the mid-60s, a huge part of what was happening with the cultural shifts back then.
So how did those racial controversies and boundary pushing, how does that apply to us today in Seattle?
Well, I think these days we need Star Trek more than ever. One of the things I like to talk about is the technology in Star Trek, okay? It's very utopian. It's very futuristic. There's all these cool tools that do these amazing things. And one of those tools is their phaser. It's their weapon. It's this pistol. And yes, when there's some kind of, you know, crazy monster, they can shoot it and kill it. But the phaser has this stun setting. A phaser can just knock someone unconscious without any harm to them. What if we had a weapon like that today? Think of the problems that could be avoided with all these unnecessary shootings that are happening it would be fantastic. So even the weapons in Star Trek had a certain were a way of looking at how we can make ourselves a better society.
As you know, Star Trek was could be challenging, could be boundary pushing. We mentioned the first interracial kiss, mm-hmm. et cetera. Is the exhibition making us think still?
I would like to say yes. I mentioned those interactives, the away team encounters. One of them has to do with this alien species called Trills. Now, Trills are symbiotic. So they have a host body, which looks like a person, and then they have a symbiote, which is like a worm about the size of a loaf of bread, and it lives in the stomach of the host, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What this means is the host body can die, but the symbiote can move on to a new body. So from an outsider's point of view, this person can completely change their body, can change their appearance, can change their gender. And this is a way that Star Trek, through that science fictional lens, approaches issues of same-sex relationships and transgender, which is incredibly relevant today and I think is something a lot of people are having to think about and may or may not make them uncomfortable. And so in the exhibit, we ask them, hey, what if you fell in love with someone, deeply in love with someone, and then the next day they were in a different body, perhaps with a different gender? What would you do? And we're asking people to really decide, is love entirely based on what's on the inside, or does physical appearance and attraction play, how much of a role does it play for them?
We think of ourselves as in a, we're kind of in a little progressive bubble mm-hmm. in Seattle, and mm-hmm. maybe happily so, mm-hmm. depends who you are. Do you think that the ideas in Star Trek would have challenged our ideas of ourselves as progressive?
There's a thing in Star Trek called the Prime Directive, and the Prime Directive is a rule that says don't interfere with societies that are less technologically advanced than we are. And back in the 60s, even that was an easy definition. No one questioned, oh, how do you measure if someone is more or less technologically advanced? It was just obvious to them. Now I think that's in of itself problematic. But at its core, it's about foreign policy, right? It's about, is it right for one culture who thinks they know a better way to live to step in and impose those ideas on others or suggest it? Over and over again in Star Trek, you see this issue being played out and relating to today's world, because it's easy enough to say, yeah, don't interfere with other folks. But sometimes those folks on other worlds, those aliens, have a resource that's very useful that people in Star Trek want. So then things start to get a little fuzzy. Certainly, again, it's something that's playing out today in the world theater constantly.
Do you find Seattle to be a hot spot for science fiction? That's what I think of it that way.
As far as I can tell, Seattle is...
In the Pacific Northwest?
I think Seattle and the Pacific Northwest is just chock full of people interested in science fiction, and they come at it from different directions. There are fans who just love the stories, love the shows, the movies, what have you. And there are a lot of people who overtly or covertly are obsessed with creating the future through what they do and what they develop.
Now that's interesting. Yeah, we have a lot of de facto futurists buzzing around working here.
And there's this generation of entrepreneurs and technologists who grew up on Star Trek. And many of them will say very directly, oh, yeah, that was a huge influence on me. Someone like Jeff Bezos or Paul Allen, Nathan Myhrvold.
Can you see how Star Trek influenced Bezos or Allen or Myhrvold?
Well, is there a billionaire in this town who doesn't have a rocket company and isn't trying to get to space? It's like they're having their own little space race of their own. But also Seattle, well, more and more it looks like the future in this city as they keep building these glass towers. I always feel like I'm living in the future out here.
Brooks Peck, curator of Star Trek Exploring New Worlds, which is on view now at the EMP Museum. We're tweeting out a link to photos from that exhibit right now, so follow us at KUOW. You just heard Brooks Peck say that in Seattle, sometimes it feels like we're living in the future. Well, sometimes we like to pull you back into Seattle's past. For example, we're a beautiful city now, but you know, we've had some work done. Writer Knute Berger told us that Seattle's had more plastic surgery than an aging Hollywood star. In fact, he said seeing the original Seattle would surprise most locals.
I don't think they realize that Lake Washington wasn't originally connected with Puget Sound. People don't realize that the Duwamish River wasn't straight. The entire industrial area of the city, Sodo and the industrial district, was all gorgeous tide flats and Duwamish Delta. It was this wildfowl and sea life rich place that was literally just filled in with dirt so we could build factories.
Knute wrote in Crosscut that we should take a break from arguing about what we should do in the future and reflect on what we would undo about our past. So we asked you, listener, if you could reverse any of the changes we made to Seattle, what would it be? On Facebook, Kristen tells us we should have never built Aurora. Neighborhood separating, people unfriendly, dangerous eyesore. Will writes, have to go back to saving the interurban. Look it up. Then revisit the turning down of the subway system in the late 70s. And last, override the decision to cancel the monorail system from West Seattle to Ballard. Finally, Julanne writes, I'd go back and tell the mayor the super train is the way to go. Coffee, great music, they will park and ride, I know they will. Nicely done, Julanne. Someone remembers the 1992 movie set in Seattle called Singles.
This is what I've been working on. If you had a train, right, a super train, you give the people a good reason to get out of their cars, you give them great coffee, great music, they will park and ride. I know they will.
Oh, poor Steve. To which Kira Sedgwick's character says, I still love my car, though. Thank you, listeners. Keep talking to us. Find KUOW on Facebook and Twitter or email us record@kuow.org. Maybe they'll do a single sequel with Steve now obsessed with self-driving cars. It seems to be on the way. The White House yesterday came out in support of autonomous vehicles, saying they plan to regulate the software that operates them. We'll have more on that story coming up later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered.